Founding support for The Reading Life comes from Octavia Books. Additional support comes from the Helles Foundation and the Louisiana Endowment for the Humanities, the state affiliate of the National Endowment for the Humanities. Hello and welcome to The Reading Life, your weekly look at the Louisiana literary scene. I'm Susan Larson. This week I'll be talking with poet Ralph Adamo, whose new collection is All Fall Down, Poems 2020 through 2024. We'll also revisit my interview with E.M. Tran, whose novel, Daughters of the New Year, has just been selected as this year's One Book, One New Orleans. Ralph Adamo is a New Orleans native, a longtime and prolific poet and editor. He's the author of 9 collections and the editor of 8, including the wonderful I Hope It's Not Over and Goodbye, Selected Poems of Everett Maddox. That's one of my favorites, as you know.
Mine too.
He was also the editor of Barataria in the mid-70s, the New Orleans Review in the mid to late 90s, and he's currently the editor of Xavier Review in the Xavier Review Press, which is housed at the HBCU, Xavier University of Louisiana, where he's been a professor of English since the year after Katrina. Today we're talking about his 9th collection, All Fall Down, Poems 2020 to 2024, published by Lavender Inc. Ralph, welcome. Welcome back.
Thank you. I'm glad to be here.
This is such an elegant looking book to hold in your hand. I love the way All Fall Down, the letters are falling down the side of the cover.
And that is Bill Lavender's work, of course. He's a fantastic editor and also design person. He designs Xavier Review for us also.
Well, that explains a lot. So I have to say, Ralph, a lot of these are very melancholy poems.
Yeah.
They're sort of looking back at life and taking stock. And to me, that's the perfect kind of poem to read this time of year.
Oh, interesting.
You know?
So a Christmas gift is what you're suggesting here, right?
Sure.
Yeah.
So what was that like for you? How did you know you had a collection of, you know, that you were ready?
That's a good question, and I don't really have a good answer, but it just felt like it. The composition of these is like, I rarely sit down and write a poem, you know, like a first draft. What I've been doing more is writing a few lines, forgetting about it, then writing a few more lines and forgetting about it. And I think some of the poems sound like they were written that way, but it's
sure,
kind of,
and some
kind
are
of,
very short.
Well, that's true, too. Those are the easy
yeah.
ones. But, you know, it, kind of the same question applies to when do I know a poem is over? And and again, I don't really have an answer. It's just kind of an intuitive thing. You know, it feels finished. It's done.
Many poet friends of yours appear in these poems.
Yeah.
And I want you to talk a little bit about that. I love to hear you talk about Everett Maddox because I got to know who he was through your work on his work, because I never had the chance to meet him.
Oh, I didn't know that.
Yeah.
You hadn't met him. Okay. Oh, you missed something.
I feel sure I did.
He was quite somebody to be around. He really was. Well, I'm losing friends. As age, you know, sort of dictates, Leon Stokesbury, who was a close friend, was a great poet, I think, not nearly recognized enough. He died a few years ago. John Stoss, just very recently. You know, I really treasure those friendships, and I don't exactly miss them because they're kind of still with me, if that
sure.
makes any
the
sense.
Sure, the work is with you.
Yeah. So I guess, in a way, they're in the book throughout the book because they're on my mind, maybe.
And there's one I love at the very beginning. It's the greatest tribute you can give another writer when you say this. Frank Stanford, of course, your old friend.
Oh, yeah.
Old friend.
Oh, yeah.
You're a poet, and you write poetry rare. Sometimes you write beautiful poems constant as night. Do you know anyone who has read your poems more than 100 times except you? I have.
I know.
I thought that was just...
I know. I was floored when he sent... That was a letter from the mid-70s. He had just started... He and Carolyn Wright had just started a Lost Roads Press and asked for a manuscript, and I gave him 2, basically, and he winnowed down 60 poems to 20 poems and said, these are the ones that should be in your book. Yeah, he was incredibly generous with his time. He was a mm-hmm. fantastic poet. About to be, by the way, I should say this because it's about to happen. A historian, James McWilliams, has been working on a biography of Frank Stanford.
There isn't one
so far. And he's spent the last 6 years, he's interviewed hundreds of people from the beginning of Frank's life to the end at 30. Mm-hmm. And that book will be published in June, University of Arkansas Press. Uh-huh. And James is going to be in town for the New Orleans Poetry Festival this year, this April, and is going to do a panel about Frank Stanford and about his work.
So you've been part of two really important poetic communities. You know, that group at the University of Arkansas yeah. is a really important group of poets. Yeah. And the New Orleans poets.
Yeah.
So talk a bit about what that's meant to your work and your professional life.
Well, the Arkansas time was extraordinary. I think, again, Leon Stokesbury, John Stoss, Frank Stanford, Sam Gwynn, Jack Butler, Julie Alvarez briefly.
Yeah.
Nancy Harris was there briefly, too. There's so many really good poets. And, you know, it's not that they teach you anything directly. It's that you just sort of learn by being around them. You know,
yeah.
you share things. And John Stoss had read 100 Years of Solitude before anybody else that I knew read it. And he said, you've got to read this book. And I did. And that was very formative because I was still in my 20s and really kind of changing from the style I brought to Arkansas to the style I left Arkansas with, which is pretty much in that first book, Sadness at the Private mm-hmm. University.
One of the great titles
it
of
is.
All time.
Thank you. That was Frank's idea, too. I wanted to call it something. I mean, it's the title of one of my poems, but it hadn't occurred to me as a title for a book.
What was it that drew you to Arkansas in the first place?
Well, it was simple. I was a student at Loyola. Miller Williams was a teacher there. He was gone the final year that I was in Arkansas. He had gone to had a job in Mexico. But he had said, you know, you should come to the University of Arkansas. He kind of facilitated mm-hmm. my application. And I don't know. I didn't know what else to do as I was graduating. Somebody was offering me a job. I probably should have taken the job. But I didn't. And so, but that was it. And at the time, now I think there are 200 and some odd Master of Fine Arts creative writing degrees available mm-hmm. in the country and worldwide, really. And at the time, there were maybe six or seven.
Yeah.
The big one being Iowa. And Arkansas had kind of bias toward a sort of formal verse. Mm-hmm. And both Miller and Jim Whitehead, who taught there, were pretty much formalists in their own work, in their own ideas. And I'm not. I wasn't then. I think it was an interesting pushback against my own inclinations as a poet. And I think I did learn a lot, again, just from being around those poets.
And then what did coming back to New Orleans do?
Well, you know, you say you didn't come till the 80s. In the 70s, yeah. when I came back from Arkansas, there was, I think, one reading series that I knew about. There were no organizations of poets. Mm-hmm. There weren't that many poets that I was aware of anyway. It might have been a few that I didn't know.
And now?
Well, I was going to say that the contrast is extraordinary. I mean, now there's a reading every night somewhere, mm-hmm. and or every afternoon and night. And there are literally, I think, several dozen poets in this city who are as good as anybody else in the country.
Right.
I went to a reading just this weekend at Rosa Keller Library, part of Gina Ferraro's series, with four extraordinary poets, Dylan Krieger, Jeff Munsterman, Andy Young, and Nikki Ummel, all of whom write differently from one another, and all of whom are, I think, brilliant poets, really, with books that we should all go out and buy. Anyway, there's just an extraordinary concentration of wonderful poets here. And then, you know, Rodney Jones lives here. Peter Cooley has lived here most of his life.
We've had steady poets. And we've
steady.
Had poets arrive and we've had poets grow up.
And poets die.
It's incredible. You also write a lot about your family in this book.
I did not used to do that. It's not that I avoided it, it's that it just didn't come to the surface. I think that also has something to do with aging.
Sure.
You know, I have memories that I didn't know I had that sort of emerge and become part of the poems. But you want your poems to have some kind of universal appeal, application. Mm-hmm. It sounds, I mean, from the question suggests, you know, these are very personal, and they are, but I hope the personal translates into the universal in this thing.
I
don't know if it does.
If you're just joining us, I'm talking with poet Ralph Adamo, whose new book is All Fall Down, Poems 2020 to 2024. You said you wanted to read two poems that you wrote about your sister, Mary.
Yeah.
She seems to have been such a muse for you.
Yeah. Again, not that I knew it until recently.
Yeah.
But yeah. She passed away a few years ago, and she had Down syndrome. Mm-hmm. And because of my mother's sort of attention to it, she did a lot of things. She, you know, she played the piano. She was a sort of tenured student at St. Michael's.
Yeah,
and,
yeah.
And just, you know, had a really effervescent personality, I guess, you know, but very sensitive. I don't think I'd ever written, well, I'd written one thing about her a long time ago, but yeah, she just sort of, again, kind of came into mind, mm-hmm. you know, as I was writing these, so yeah.
Well, let's hear one, or both.
I have to say, you know, one of the things that you worry about, I guess, writing poetry is not crossing that line into sentimentality. And I don't know if I avoided that or not with these, but the first one is called To Think Things Into Action. I have no idea why I called it that, but there it is.
I liked it.
Okay. And my sister used to call our father Daddy Adamo for vaguely Asian features glowing with happy love. In the privacy of her room, at the end of the house, she sang, she danced. She chatted with people no one could see who were clearly there. Mary's life was a mystery to me, as any sibling's life would be, except special, that word that went with her everywhere, glib as sunrise on still water.
I don't think that's sentimental. I think it's just beautiful.
Thank you. Thank you. This one, I'm not even sure this is a poem. This just feels like, if anything, it's a prose poem.
Or a meditation.
Meditation, maybe a better word for it. And I just called it Mary. When I teach creative writing or really anything, I usually bring surreal poems into it and talk about mm-hmm. surrealism, because I think it's an overused term, or it's a term that's used imprecisely a lot of times. And in a lot of, it's a deeper term, I guess, than people really think of it being. I use the word in this poem, that's why I mention that. My sister was surreal. I say the word in its expansive form, covering oceans, locked into the moon's secret frailness with its ardent constituents, and bathed in the songs of the most abused, the lostest detainees, bloody from pure joy. My sister cried in secret, alone, absent survival skills or the will to harm. It's odd, this extra chromosome, how those endowed could never make war, plan meanness, or make a mess of any form of love. My sister was forgiveness and respite, the mercy at the heart of creation. To step into her world was where you belonged when you did. She cried in secret. Just sometimes, our mother said, she'll feel sad. My sister's sadness makes my head spin with its cosmic implications. She conducted the sadness of the world. Her sacrifice went everywhere to heal the broken parts we never see.
Oh, Ralph. And now you have new poets in your own family to look forward to. You have a son who is doing very well in his writing life, Ezra.
Yes.
So what is that, like for you?
Poet. It's exciting. It's exhilarating, really. It's we talk a lot most of the time, Ezra and I, and we talk about lots of things, but including writing. Ezra has a kind of social anxiety that a lot of young people have these days.
Oh, they
and
do.
Kind of holds a lot of things close to the vest, mm-hmm. you know. But yeah, his poems are extraordinary, and his stories. I really have never read anybody's stories that are like these. I don't know if I'm missing somebody that I should know about, but Ezra's stories are extraordinary. And he's had a little bit of recognition, but hasn't sought very much, I should say.
Well, push him out a little bit.
Yeah, we're working on it.
You've been teaching long enough to see your students come along and become poets, haven't you?
Yeah, although I haven't, you know, like a lot of people in this line of work, I guess you'd have to say, teach in MFA programs or primarily teach creative writing. I don't. I haven't. I've taught a lot of freshman comp, a lot of other kinds of literature courses. I just finished teaching a course on the poetry of war. I have had some students who haven't published books and who've done well, but I don't have a long sort of train of, you know, former student poets.
No, but it's kind of nice. It's kind of nice to know you kicked a few out of the nest.
Yeah. Well, I'm happy at their successes. I really am.
We've been talking with Ralph Adamo, whose most recent collection of poems is All Fall Down, Poems 2020 to 24. Ralph, thank you so much for coming out.
Thank you for asking me and for your incredible questions and for your support. I mean, what you've meant for writers in this community is really incalculable, I think.
Oh,
I mean,
thanks.
Starting way back at the Times-Picayune.
So we both go way back, Ralph.
We do, don't we? We've got a little
funny bit
of history. So,
anyway, well, congratulations on this book.
Thank you.
Today, we're revisiting my 2022 interview with Elizabeth Tran. She's the author of The Daughters of the New Year, a novel set in New Orleans during the backdrop of the Katrina era. Appropriately enough, it is the One Book, One New Orleans selection for 2025, which marks the 20th anniversary of that storm. Elizabeth's novel gives us keen and beautiful insights into the lives of Vietnamese immigrants in our city. You wrote this book to answer your own questions about your family's history, and so much of it draws on your own background.
Yes.
And it's just fascinating that your family had one of the first Vietnamese grocery stores.
Mm-hmm.
Your father published the Vietnamese newspaper.
Yes.
I saw that picture of the grocery store, which had a lending library of Vietnamese books.
Yes.
So you grew up, obviously, in a place where books and writing were very valued.
Yeah. You know, I don't think I realized how much emphasis reading and literature had in our family until I became older.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that's, like, part of what I'm wrestling with in writing the book, is that, like, there's so much in my family that I just was unaware of, or was there the whole time, but I ignored it in adolescent kind of self-centeredness. You know, one of the things I look back on in speaking of adolescent self-centeredness is Hurricane Katrina.
Mm-hmm.
In that, like, at the time when I was 16 and we had to evacuate and we went to Baton Rouge to stay with my family. And I just remember the whole time thinking, oh, what an inconvenience to me. And, like, I can't believe I'm going through this. I have to, like, stop going to school and, you know, all these different things
yeah.
that are uprooted from my life. And my parents are doing this to me. And, you know, as an adult now, I look back and it's like, I think part of it is because you view them more as human beings as you get older, right? Like, you view your parents as people that have flaws and go through things and feel emotions. I really realize, like, okay, their whole lives are uprooted, and it's not just happening once, it's happening twice. Yes, this is the second time, if not more than that, that this has happened to them. So I never really realized that my father in particular was very, very literary, and he really rooted
us. Tell about his book, the book he wrote, which is...
Yes. It's gigantic. It's
yeah,
like humongous. He passed away in 2021. And
I'm
so
sorry.
Yes, it was very upsetting. But he finished his book before he passed away. So he, like, realized this lifelong dream of, like, writing this gigantic book. And in the last years of his life, every time I would speak to him, it was about this book. Like, he was just, let me tell you about my book. I'm like, what are you doing? What are you up to, Dad? He's like, working on my book. I would kind of ask him, like, what is the book about? And what's funny is that he would tell me it's about everything, pretty much, which is essentially like saying it's about nothing.
Yeah, of course.
So, I mean, I think that that's like the central, like, that is why I think throughout my life, I've known very little, or I've had very little connection to my culture is, because it was very easy for me to just be like, oh, okay, like he already told me about it, or like I already know about this, so I'm not going to delve further, because the answer was always a kind of skirting around the truth, or like a, such a broad statement like, oh, it's, you know, it's about everything.
Or that was then and this is now. And,
yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. But, you know, because I was older, I began, and because I, you know, I was starting to write the book at that time, and I was also writing about like my family and about mm-hmm. our history. I had caught on to their tricky ways. And, you know, I was a little bit better about asking questions. So his book was actually about, you know, he wasn't lying. It was about apparently
everything.
All literature, Vietnamese literature from the beginning, he says, up into the present, which is a huge undertaking. It's more of like a literary history, mm-hmm. I would say. And his whole project was, you know, after leaving Vietnam, you know, after the fall of Saigon, the communists, with many new regimes, they get rid of all of the literature, all of the culture, the cultural right. artifacts that contradict what they want the history to be. And so he felt like his generation was disappearing or was being erased. And so his whole project was to reestablish that. So I feel like that is like something that I've always been very fascinated with in my own writing too, just like not necessarily reestablishing history, but watching him do it.
Of course. And seeing the enormity of the task.
Yeah, it's huge.
You know, but the modeling of the writing life for you.
Yes. Yeah, was very, very structured, and he always put his writing first, which whenever you talk about writing with writers, it's always the same kind of conversation, like, oh, I don't have time to write. I it's so difficult to write. Sometimes you just stare at the blank page. And for him, I like have no idea how he did it, but he was always writing. He was always reading. We had all these books, or he had all these books, and you could point to any book on the shelf and he would tell you about what that book was about. So
where is this book now?
Where is his book now?
Yeah.
It's interesting. I did not know this until quite recently, that there's like a whole Vietnamese literary scene that is the, you know, the diaspora of mm-hmm. people who have been displaced. So a lot of populations in Australia and France, the U.S., Canada, and they have this whole literary network of Vietnamese writers and thinkers and, you know, culture bearers who have been displaced from
right.
Vietnam. And they are the main market for his book.
Oh, how wonderful.
Yes. And so they all, like, you know, keep writing articles. They have their own literary journals and they exchange ideas amongst each other. So they've created their kind of own, like, literary safe space and academic thinking space.
And now they'll read your book.
I hope so.
I mean, how could they not?
Yeah.
Oh. Now, one of the things that's so striking about this book, and you say you're not a poet, but you have that gift of making things beautiful and making them come to life. And there is one object that particularly inspires you to write this story that you look at all the time.
Yes.
And I wonder if you'd talk a little bit about that object and why it was so important.
Yes. So you're talking about the trophy,
of
right?
Of course. Of course.
Yeah, so the trophy, I feel like, is a very central part of the book, just because I feel like For Xuân, the mother of Nhi, Chu, and Trac, is formative for her. This trophy is representative of all kinds of things. Her beauty, of her agency and power, of life lost, of like a former life that she can no longer access, that's represented in this object. And so I thought that it was a really good object to kind of ground us as we go through, because the book is very episodic and we do move mm-hmm. through perspective every single chapter.
We've been talking with Elizabeth Tran, Daughters of the New Year. This year's One Book, One New Orleans selection. Events begin later in January, so start reading now. What's on tap in the literary life this week? Augustus Durham discusses in Signs Stay Black and Die on Melancholy and Genius, Saturday, January 11th at 2 at Baldwin & Company. The Splice Poetry Series presents a reading with Evie Shockley, Caroline Bergvall, Carlos Soto Roman, Whitney DeVos, Clint Burham, Mandy Gutman Gonzalez, Kate Peebles, Alicia Wright, Amish Trivedi, Edgar Garcia, Laura Jaramillo, and William Hazard at the Saturn Bar. That's Saturday, January 11th at 7. Francois Bureau reads from and signs his book, San Diego Stories, Sunday, January 12th at 3:30 at Octavia Books. Kat McKenzie discusses her romantic comedy, Work in Progress, in conversation with Alexandra Vasti, Tuesday, January 14th at 6 at the Garden District Bookshop. Kwame Alexander presents his children's book, How Sweet the Sound, Tuesday, January 14th from 6 to 8 at Baldwin & Company. Mardi Gras Authority Arthur Hardy gives a talk at 7, Tuesday, January 14th at the East Bank Regional Library in Metairie. Rashad Bilal and Troy Millings discuss and sign You Deserve to Be Rich, Master the Inner Game of Wealth and Claim Your Future, Thursday, January 16th at 6 at Baldwin & Company. This is a ticketed event. Elisa Speranza teaches a class, Your Book is Not Going to Sell Itself, Planning Your Publicity Strategy, Saturday, January 18th from 1 to 4 at the NOCA Foundation. For registration information, visit neworleanswriters.org. Founding support for The Reading Life comes from Octavia Books. Additional support comes from the Hellis Foundation, the Jefferson Parish Public Library, and the Louisiana Endowment for the Humanities, the state affiliate of the National Endowment for the Humanities. Any views, findings, conclusions, or recommendations expressed in The Reading Life do not necessarily represent those of the National Endowment for the Humanities. The theme song for The Reading Life is by Matt Perrine and Sunflower City. The Reading Life is produced by George Ingmeyer and is a production of WWNO. You can listen to us anytime or subscribe to our podcast at WWNO.org. And you can email us at thereadinglife@WWNO.org.